Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Your Intention Matters, the podcast. My name, of course, is still Paul Madat. Thank you very much for freeing up the time to listen to this episode. I have Ezekiel Blattler. He is VP of Sales at Dosis, coming to us from, you're in Vegas right now, I know, but you're based out of San Diego, man. How are things, Zeke?
Doing really well. Yes, I'm very fortunate to live in San Diego. When I lived in Chicago and I moved out there, a lot of people tell me, you're going the wrong direction. You need to go back. So after tour duty in Chicago, I'm glad to be back in San Diego.
Well, nice to meet you, man. I appreciate the time. Do me a favor, say hi to everybody and provide a quick intro, and then we'll get into your story here.
Sure. Hi, everyone. You can just call me Zeke Blattler. Been in several sales roles, I think 12 or 13 sales roles in the last 10 years. Constantly learning and just really blessed to be in a new opportunity with cannabis.
All right. I'm calling you Zeke Elliott, right? That must have changed your life a little bit in the last 3 or 4 years with your name.
Yeah, people know the name now.
All right, good. Well, listen, looking forward to you getting into your story here. As you know, Zeke, the title of the podcast is called Your Intention Matters, and that's really built on the foundation, and nothing has really been given to most of us in our life, and everything starts with what's up top with mindset and intention. And most of us in the world of sales and sales leadership and training and whatever never thought we'd even get into sales, let alone sustain a career in it. And I think you fall into that category. So I'm looking forward to you sharing your story. You ready to roll here?
Sure.
All right, man. Let's go back in time with this one. That's what we do on this podcast. We're going back early 2000s, 2003, Cal State Long Beach. Talk to me, man. Language interpretation and translation Spanish. That doesn't have sales anywhere close to it, man. What were you thinking you'd be doing with that type of education?
Yeah, so growing up in Southern California, I actually wanted to be a lawyer, and I wanted to be an immigration lawyer. And so plenty of work there, by the way. And so by learning Spanish, I also took a business Spanish, a one-year program. And I took in my LSAT, and I told, everyone that I knew, I was like, hey, I'm going to go be a lawyer. I'm going to do this. And then while I was in college, I was working at a fine dining restaurant. And to be good or to make money, I had to learn about wine, and particularly wine sales. Like bartenders and servers, they're salespeople. Like if you watch them, certain ones will sell more desserts, sell more water, a lot of water, sell more coffee, and they're getting repetitions every day. And so I really have a passion for wine. And when I told my mom I was not going to go to law school and stay in restaurants, it did not go well at all. She was not too pleased about hearing that.
So, you know, your vision for being a lawyer, where did that come from? Was it LA Law and like the TV shows and watching Suits and stuff like that? And or was there something around the actual support of people and helping people? What was driving your vision for being a lawyer?
You know, I think both. Like, I think the part about you kind of watch some of those shows and where someone like presents that case and that point, and it's, you're like, wow,
there's the bloody knife.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it kind of felt like that. Growing up, people say, oh, I took speech and debate. It felt very natural to do, but some of my mom, right? Like, hey, be a doctor, be a lawyer. And, you know, me just trying to be a good son, following
like a professional, right?
Yeah. Cause right. No one says like when you tell people you come from restaurants and, you know, they have this stigma to it, but there's a lot that can be learned in that business. It moves fast and it's tough.
So how long did you get into the restaurant game?
So I had done it, when I was in San Diego. And then, so when I was in Long Beach, you know, I was there, I became like GM of two restaurants. And, you know, truth be told, I got let go at the second restaurant, and I had felt I had done the best job I'd done in my life at that point. You know, I was managing like 50, 60 people. I thought I did a great job. And then, you know, hearing that you're being let go for whatever reason, I wouldn't even tell people I got fired. I'd be like, oh, you know, it was mutual. I got laid off. But, you know, now that I have some more time, I'm like, you know what? I got fired. And the very next day, someone called me from Southern Wine and Spirits and they said, hey, I heard you're available. And so really getting fired was one of the best things that ever happened to me. But at the time, a lot of shame, a lot of embarrassment on that way home.
You know, well, you know, Zeke, your transparency, I think, is refreshing because I think most of us have been in that spot. And what you just said to me kind of resonated because I was the guy where when I was fired, I was embarrassed. It was almost 20 years ago and it was like a punch to the gut. It's like, what am I going to do now? How much money do I have? Where am I going to go? And it was embarrassing because I thought I was doing the right stuff, but I would say, oh, I got laid off. No, I was canned. I got fired and it wasn't, they didn't dissolve my position. They replaced me. So I got fired. And then likewise with my education, I mean, for the longest time, I was the guy who said I graduated, but I didn't. It was the sense of they're going to judge me. And over time, you realize, no, the more transparent you are. At the time, I just wasn't mature enough to continue on. And so I cut bait after 2 years. And so, okay, so you know, get removed from your job, you're fired. Mm-hmm. But the very next day, you have a job interview. Any idea, any recollection as to how they found you that quickly?
Yeah, you know, how the world works and I've been, you know, fortunate in a lot of stuff in my career. And it was an ex-coworker from the restaurant who worked there now. He called me. His name's Kevin. Kevin, if you're listening, thank you for calling
me. Shout out to Kevin.
And it did take like a couple months for it all to go. But he's like, hey, we have this wine manager position. Would you be interested? And you know, going into sales roles, you're brand new. And a lot of these companies, they kind of just hand you a bag, give you a pat on the butt and say, go. So it was a bit, you know, overwhelming in the beginning, walking to Southern Glazer's, which is the largest distributor in the United States. And walk in the building, see everyone in suits and ties. And, you know, you hear the lingo and the language they use. And you get a little bit of that imposter syndrome. Like, do I belong here? Am I good enough? Like, wow, these people really know their business. But like most things in life, when you get in and you start playing the game, you start figuring it out.
You know, you mentioned earlier in the conversation that you have a passion for wine. I presume that that probably, you know, had a big factor in any success that you've had because it was a genuine interest in the product, not just a means to an end. If it's going to pay the rent and the car payment and everything else. But so I'm curious, did you ever pursue a sommelier path?
So I am a certified sommelier. Now there's four levels. There's like the intro, the certified, advanced, and then master sommelier. The guy who trained me, he told me like, it will take so much of your life to be the advanced that it's just better to be certified. So, you know, I would think wine is for everybody. And I don't like when, you know, someone is like looking down on me because I drink, you know, whatever wine or whatever whiskey or whatever beer. Like a lot of people just want to enjoy a drink. So I try to have the balance between, you know, having the knowledge, but also understanding it with sales. Your broad market is much larger than, you know, the sell market, right? It's just a much smaller piece of the business.
You know, I have great respect for the sommelier skill because, you know, I'm a guy who I like a glass of wine. My wife she likes a good glass, but I don't pretend to know boo about them, quite frankly. I'll look at the year and I'll think, oh, well, the Napa is a nice region. So is Italy. Is an Argentina wine good? I have no idea. So I have great respect for the knowledge and depth. And, you know, my partner, Dave, my business partner, he gave me a tip years ago. He said, you know, I remember I went into a restaurant with him and of course this restaurant gave me the, this book of wines and it was like a novel of wine. So I'm trying to decipher this. He says, Paul, here's what you should do. He says, when you come into a restaurant and you're looking to order some wine and he says, you're not that comfortable with the knowledge of wine. He says, ask the waiter to go find the sommelier and then go talk to the sommelier on the side and have a conversation with, say, listen, I've got my wife here. I've got business partners here. I've got clients, whatever. I don't know squat about the product. I want a nice wine. You know, I need some support here. I'm looking for, he basically said, you want to ask for the $1,000 bottle of wine for $100. Like, and the sommelier knows which one that is, right? Mm. Which one has that taste. And so I've always respected, because they come back and they make me look like a rock star, because I just, you know, I just went in advance to have that conversation. So, but I appreciate your comment about that skill set, because it's a true art to know, you know, what goes on, because I just know how to pop the bottle. That's about it.
That was great advice that he gave you, because, you know, what I'll tell you, when you approach a table as a sommelier, the GM or the server, I'm looking at the watch you're wearing, the clothes you're wearing, the guests with you, and then even the items you're looking at on the menu. And so the first things you would do is, I'd want to find out a comfortable range. Like, we don't want to stick you with $1,000 bottle. I want to stick you with the bottle you're going to love for you. And so sometimes people would come in, like Mother's Day and Valentine's Day, you could take unlimited reservations, right? So some of those people that are buying the $25 wine, the house wine, this is a really big moment for them. And so you have to take care of them the same. The person who buys the $200 bottle wine eats and does that many times. It actually means less to him. But, you know, I've seen where you sell someone a $500 wine and they have it, and they're like, thank you so much, right? And that's the part about, so you go to the wine list, I point and I show them a high wine, a low wine. I get where they kind of go. I would ask you, hey, Paul, what do you normally drink? What does your wife normally drink? Like, no, zero preconceived notions. I'm trying to solve a problem that you have, right? Like you've come in here, you're trying to take care of your guests, and it's nerve wracking when you look at a giant book and you're like, oh, great. Look at these.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. So good. It's a fun conversation thus far. So, all right. So Kevin finds you, plucks you out, realizes that you're on the market here. You work for Southern Glazers. For how long were you there for?
I was there for 2 years and 2 months.
Okay. So just over 2 years. Was this still in Southern California?
It was. Yeah.
Okay.
North Orange County.
And what was behind your departure? Was it your choice this time?
Yeah. So I guess someone's going to look at my LinkedIn. You know, Southern California it's a wonderful place to live. And a lot of the people in wine and spirits, they get to certain roles and they just don't leave. And I don't blame them, right? Like, so I think the average tenure at the time, my dream was to be a division manager. And I actually never got that job. But I think the average tenure at one point was like 7 to 11 years, or some people 26 years in role. There's some people 8 years in role. Because you got to that role, you ran a pretty big business, and you lived in Southern California. Like, you weren't moving. Yeah. And so I wanted to get that role. And I also wanted to go back to San Diego. And so I went to Young's Market Company. And the really cool thing about that, I went from selling two major suppliers, Diageo, Moët Hennessy, two of the biggest in the world, to selling a multitude of suppliers, selling energy, drinks, coffee, and then, you know, Tito's, Fireball, Bacardi, you know, different whiskeys. And so you get to see all of these business plans, right? And by the way, everyone thinks they're hitting their business plan. So I see 50 suppliers, 100, and they're like, this is what we're going to do this year. And you quickly can figure out who has a concise strategy and who doesn't. You know, like, do they know what they're trying to do? Like, in the simplest terms, what are you trying to do? What is your commander's intent? And it was really, it was just a great experience going to that role. And it was a much larger team. It was 11 sales reps on the team. The previous team that I was on had 6. And then I was on a key count team that had like 12. So it was a really good experience.
Was the transition what you thought it would be? Was it harder than you thought early on?
Oh, great question. I was nervous. Like, when you're selling Diageo, Captain Morgan, Crown Royal, Johnnie Walker Black, and they just tell you, like, these brands deliver and they pull Ketel One. So to me, I had believed it was some of the brands, and I was going to a team with different brands, and I was like, am I going to be able to succeed? So I was nervous. But again, right when you get in the game and you're inside restaurants and bars, you're selling, they're human beings, we're human beings. Someone's going to win. And I found that it was more about the talent on the team and the direction, and less the brands you're selling. Now, brands are important. I'm not in any way diminishing that.
Sure.
But you're just competing. It's like groups of teams competing. And so I was nervous at first, but once we got going, pretty excited.
I think everybody listening probably wants to know, employee discount?
Well, you will get a lot of samples. I have probably 100 bottles at my house that I never drink. So right. Most people, wine and spirits, definitely have a lot of product in their garage, and they actually end up drinking very little of it because it's only for special occasions.
Fair enough. All right. So you're at Young's, you make the shift, and what was your tenure like there for how long?
I was there for 2 years.
Another 2 years. Okay.
Yeah. You know, that division manager thing I was chasing, you know, it just didn't work out for me. There was timing, and, you know, I wanted to learn more. And so I was predominantly in the restaurant division, which is about 26% of the business in Southern California, but the chains like the Kroger's, Albertsons, Ralph's, Costco's 50. So I wanted to do more. I wanted to work in like the liquor stores in the chain business and broaden my horizon. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Beam Suntory. I mean, again, a huge lucky moment in my life. I met, you know, one of my mentors, Bob Robbins, really changed my whole career.
And were you there for 2 years as well?
I was there for 4 years.
All right. We got past the 2 years. All right.
But I did 2 years in San Diego, and then we're San Diego, Orange, Palmdale, and I got promoted to Chicago.
Oh.
And when I told my wife we were going from San Diego to Chicago, she cried. It's a true story. It wasn't tears of joy. But wonderful experience. One of the hardest transitions of my life, doing that but getting through that was great.
So Zeke, why was it so hard? I mean, and I asked the question because, you know, I live in Toronto. I don't live in the States, but I'm down in the US a fair amount. And I've been to Chicago many times, and I've been to Southern California many times. And I know that, you know, you live in the same country, but there's different pockets of the country with different, you know, outlooks and different, you know, ways of life and so on. And I know that the weather is a big difference between Chicago and San Diego, but San Diego's big, Chicago's big. So like what made it so hard to transition from where you were to Chicago?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So the winter there is pretty much Halloween till Easter. So no one tells you it's a 5-month winter, but you know, going to that role, so I'd worked in Los Angeles, which is our number two major market in the US, and going to Chicago and meeting, you know, a distributor team of about 40 or 50, meeting our team. And, you know, one of the very first, you know, pain points I discovered, I went to this meeting with one of the vice presidents of our distributor. And I said, hey, you know, in California, we used to get these inventory reports. And if you send them to us, you know, we can watch the inventory too. I won't use it against you, because what happens is if they run out of stock on something as our distributor, the suppliers usually get mad. Like, how could you guys, your demand planning was bad. We got this on quota. And I was like, look, I'm not going to use it against you. We just need to know. And we did this out in California. It worked well. And he said, two things for you, Zeke. First thing, we're not in California. We're in Illinois. Secondly, we don't have an inventory problem. Any questions? No, sir. Get out of my office. And, you know, I walked back and I was like, oh, wow, this is going to be a challenge here. Yeah. But I hadn't built any consensus. I come into this guy's office and I'm asking for stuff day one, like dumb move on my part. So after working with that sales force and really understanding what their problems and solutions were, we ended up having two incredible years over the winning plan and saw the Cubs win the World Series.
Oh, well, yeah, that would have been a great time. 2016, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, 2016. I mean, you talk about, you mentioned your wife's tears going to Chicago. There were a lot of tears at that time, but tears of joy with the Cubs finally winning, right? So it was just 100 years or so. So, all right, so you're in Chicago. You figured out, you know, how to make it work. And I assume you become acclimated to the Chicago way of life, but yeah, now you're back in Southern California.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting, you know, I want to tell you a story about, you know, my manager at Beam in Chicago is actually my boss's boss. And he's how, you know, I went to Jewel. But we were sitting down one day and we were talking about business, and he told me a story which fundamentally changed how I managed. Cause I thought I was pretty special, and by the way, I'm not. And he said, you know, Zeke, in business, and in sports, there's a salary cap. And so you can't get all the best players. He goes, but in business, there is no salary cap. So if you hire the best people, pay them well, let them do the job. And he goes, if you get all the best people on your team, not only will you win, you'll get blowouts. And he's like, I don't like blowouts. And so when I went to Illinois, we did a lot of interviewing. There was this team being hired. I really thought about talent more because I used to think that I was special and that I could just figure out value props and what brand's moving, blah, blah, blah. But to really understand that you can't do it by yourself and you have to have players around you. So what I did from that moment on, I asked like 50 top performers in my network. I was like, who's your favorite boss? What do they do? Like, how did they treat you? And it came down to, you know, they just want to be trusted. They want to be able to own their business. Do you care about their career as much as yours? And that thing. And then, so Bob goes on to work at like the VP strategy Constellation. Then he goes to Jewel and I get this phone call and he's like, hey, I know you want to get back to California. I have a role at this company. It's an e-cigarette company. And I'm like, there's no way my wife's saying yes to this. Like zero chance. But the quick backstory is that is my
zero chance that she would have said no to go back to California.
Not Jewel, like an e-cigarette company.
Gotcha.
Like she's just like, I don't understand enough of this. So I got the product and my older sister had smoked since she was 14. And I'm a very strict Asian mom. And her way of telling her to stop was you smell terrible. Don't be around your nieces and nephews. Get out of the house. And basically kind of saying you're weak. Cigarette smoke, quitting smoke is hard. The average smoker tries to quit 30 times. So seeing that Jewel actually worked to help my sister quit, allowed my wife to say yes. And, you know, we went there, we scaled the West region was 6 people. I think at one point, you know, went all the way up to 62. And, you know, doing that repetition of hiring and bringing in talent and just, I mean, I was a salesperson number 29 and we were up to like 1200 within a year. Like it was,
wow. Holy mackerel.
It was like nothing I've ever been. I felt like all I was doing is interviewing, but we had such an amazing team there in the talent and the Silicon Valley mindset as well is hire the best and brightest and just give them resources and attack. And it was really just invigorating working with that team there. It was special.
Zeke, man, it's been quite the ride you've had thus far. I'm fascinated by this story here. I want to chat with you about 2020 because I know that, you know, as a world, we're going through uncharted waters on a number of different levels across the board. I do take some solace in the fact that it's a world problem. It's not just Canada. It's not just the U.S. It's not one company, but we're all kind of going through this. But you have a new job during this time. So how does that happen? How do you get a new job like in the summertime during the middle of a pandemic?
Yeah, I'm a late bloomer. And I think for me, it's more about learning and like, can I get the most out of myself, not really about pay. And so when a recruiter reached out to me about coming to Dosis, and I guess I get to report to the C-suite, it's a smaller company, but we just saw 5 states legalize. Also with the majority of these state governments being upside down due to the lost tax revenue because of coronavirus, like you have a giant kind of legacy illicit market, right? So the estimates are there's 70 million cannabis users in the United States. So I just felt like I would be getting early in an industry and getting work. And then our company in particular focuses more on health and wellness and, you know, anxiety and sleep issues. And so it rolled together again, because again, my wife, you know, she's the ultimate boss. I got to get her permission when I do these jobs. And the health and wellness part about our company, something really strong and resonated with her. And so, yeah, I decided to make the move in the middle of the pandemic. And, you know, a lot has changed. I think, you know, direct to consumer e-commerce has really been accelerated in the cannabis industry. 40% of the orders are generated on the phone and on your laptop. And so that's a shift. Literally a year ago, everyone wants to be in the stores, visual merchandising. Well, now 40% of that business is now in someone's laptop or phone. How do you look there, right? How do you get the messaging right there? And then we talked about this a little bit earlier, emailing and cold calling, like that is very hard work to do.
Yeah.
And the good people can take 100, 200 no's and keep going.
Zeke, man, you've had quite the story here. Your visions of being a lawyer, you go to school for language and Spanish and translation. And you have to have a conversation with your mom that I'm not going to become a lawyer. I'm not going to be that professional mom that you have me to be, wanting to be. You get into the restaurant game, you get into the wine game, you move across the country. Now you're back in Southern California, new gig in the middle of a pandemic. What's been your foundation, man? What's worked for you in your life thus far? What's kind of been your baseline?
You know, I think now I get it about talent. Like if you think of sports, and I know you're from Canada, but like if you think about these legacy,
dude, sports, we have sports in Canada.
No, but I'm gonna go into like if you look at like Alabama football, like Duke basketball,
yeah,
Kentucky basketball. They essentially replace a quarter of their employees every year. But the reason why they win is because they get tons of talent, they buy into a system, and they have no egos. And everyone says, hey, I want the all-star team. It's not the all-star. It's going against them. It's knowing that their 15th best guy is better than your second through sixth.
Yeah.
And so if you can get the all-star team together in sales, and that means I have to have no ego, I have to listen to them all the time, and you have to worry about their careers. But if you do it right, I would say my old team that I've worked with, Jewel, like I just felt so lucky every day working with so many amazing people. And so that's the thing for me is it's about talent. It's about interviewing and really going deep on that because it's the most important thing you do is putting really good players on your team. Like there's nothing more important than having great players.
Zeke, man, it's been great speaking with you. I really appreciate the time. Thanks for being here, man.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right. You're welcome. All right, everybody. Let's wrap another episode up right now. Remember, your intention matters. Why? Because I'm telling you, that's the result you'll tend to get. We're out of here. We'll do it again next week. And be safe, everybody.